Welcome to the show.
Don't get stalked if you're getting stalked.
Jesus Christ.
We're going to talk about stalking today.
Yeah, yes. Just don't do it.
Don't do it either.
Don't stalk others.
And don't get stalked.
Okay, that's our show.
That's my advice to you all. You're welcome.
Yeah, no. We're making light of a very serious matter because that's a good coping skill.
No, it's terrifying, and it happens a lot more than people think. I would advise, if you have not, listen to part one of this series that I did, I don't know, been over a month now.
Yeah, I will look it up, the date of the episode, and let them know.
We talked about, in the first episode, we talked a little bit about, just to kind of recap that, even for those of you who did listen to it.
Yeah, tell the people where we're at, Kathy.
Ooh, I'm going to tell you. We talked a little bit about stalkers, but a different type of stalker, right? So like I did walk through the typologies of, you know, the celebrity stalker or the one who might be more mentally ill and delusional and really differentiated that from this type of stalker. What I'm going to be talking about and what I began talking about on the first episode is the stalker that someone has most often been in a relationship with.
Okay.
Okay, so this is someone who has maybe been in a narcissistically abusive or coercively controlling relationship with someone. They're trying to leave that relationship. And we know that the laws around couples... I just saw this statistic yesterday. If you kill somebody outside of your house.
Okay. Instead of inside.
You could get up to 25 years in prison. Mm-hmm. If you kill them inside your house, you could get 15. Mm-hmm. And so basically what it's saying is if this person's an intimate partner, they have more jurisdiction over you. Mm-hmm. And there's less protection for victims who know their partners, because there's this idea that it's somehow partially the victim's fault that this dynamic has happened. And we've also seen folks go to prison or lose their children for defending themselves against a perpetrator who may be an intimate partner or a previous intimate partner.
I kind of see this as us devaluing emotion as well.
Very much. In fact, I was just asked this week, I'm going to be speaking at a judicial conference in July in Arizona. And they approached me and they said, we really need a forensic psychologist to come in and essentially educate judges on information that they're refusing to allow in testimony, that they're not really vetting evaluators and their experience in this. And because what it's doing is it's creating victim blaming and it's allowing perpetrators to get custody or to control the narrative.
So yeah, it's like speaking to a crowd that doesn't really want to agree with you. So you're going in with like an advocacy, like, let me try to present it in a way that you might actually start doing this because you're...
Well, it's not necessarily that they disagree. It's that they don't, you know...
They don't have the law to support it?
They don't have the background in psychology to understand how without a certain amount of context, whether judges, just like politicians, believe that they aren't ruling on emotion, they oftentimes are, and they will oftentimes rule from a place of pseudo-justice.
Of course, right? Bias is in us all, right?
Right, but they won't admit that.
No,
so it's like
not.
There's a level of pseudo-justice. Like, if you're emotional in here, I'm just going to side with this side.
Yeah.
Because you're pissing me off. You need to shut... I've literally heard judges say, just stop. This shit needs to stop, right? Without getting down that rabbit hole too far, the point is there are judges out there that are like, I need to know how to understand like what should be considered credible and how do we begin to do that? So I'm going to be giving a presentation to judges and attorneys on how do we wake people up to understanding what coercive control really looks like and how many custodial evaluations and things that are, you know, make rulings on which parents should get how much time and all that are often incredibly poorly done and cannot be understood by an untrained eye, because a lot of these evaluators who are paid off by the court to write things, if you don't know what you're looking for, it's really easy to just believe the report.
Of course. Right? I'll interject that the first part of this discussion was published on January 17th, and the name of the episode is Stalking, Surveillance, and Coercive Control: Education to Protect Yourself, Part 1. And then while we were doing that episode, it became clear to me that it would be great for Kathy to do a second episode, because it kind of was like, well, how do we want to tell people to protect themselves? Like, how can we help you guys help yourself?
And I think that we also have to really be aware that coercive control, I actually had to explain to an attorney the other day, because I'm treating a woman who I may at some point have to testify in court on her behalf. The attorney, older male, really didn't understand what the issue was. And I literally had to write a 4-page report breaking down this type of abuse. And I talked about in the very first episode in this 2-part series, how if you want to know more about coercive control, which I won't go into as much depth in this episode, would be to look at Evan Stark's work. Because it's not that he coined the phrase, but what he did is he took elements of stuff that had been done before him and essentially turned it into something theoretical that changed legislation.
Great.
So now it's qualified in certain states and it's getting there, right? But a lot of folks don't understand, well, why can't somebody just leave? And how is this different from other forms
of just don't do it.
Emotional abuse?
Just get out.
Very, very different.
Just stop it.
That's right.
Don't put up with it. Yeah, those are all the things we hear, right?
That's right. So just to do, before I go into this, just a really, really quick recap. So Evan Stark will say it limits the victim's ability to take action through the use of confusion, contradiction, and fear. Those are the three elements that are most important. Those are the benchmarks: confusion, contradiction, and fear. Goes on to discuss how it's a largely unidentified form of subjugation that subverts, most often, a woman's autonomy and makes the woman look crazy and paranoid to the outside world. So it's really important to understand that it's highly unidentified, which is why a lot of times courts will go, well, you chose to be with this person. Mm-hmm. Why are you still there? Okay.
I understand the question.
Now, you're one of these people, or maybe you're listening to this and you're like, oh my God, I've been in this. How do we protect ourselves from coercive control, especially if we have a legal system, judicial system that's still going, what the hell is this? Like, I understand the statute. I can read, you know, what I'm supposed to do. And this person might be able to get a protective order, but how do I actually qualify this? How do I know I'm not protecting the perpetrator, right? So in this episode, we're going to talk about stalkers that are known to the target. And I also want to be clear that there isn't a one-size-fits-all policy, and there are times where coercive control can be inescapable for people. And so I don't mean to oversimplify it, because it can be very, very difficult. And I'm also not here to give legal advice, okay? I want to be clear about that. If you are going through something like this, please make sure that you seek out help. Because everybody's situation is very, very different. So I'm just going to give some broad strokes, generalizations, what we know about risk assessment, what we know about ignoring people who might be violent, whether it be emotionally or physical. One of the things I will throw out, though, is when you Google what to do, the internet immediately tells you to call the police and get a restraining order. Please pause before you do that, because restraining orders can actually create more problems than help. Especially if you're dealing with someone who doesn't abide by the law. They're not going to take it. They're not going to care. And they're going to look at that as, oh, I'm going to double down now because you just did this. So you really want to make sure that you get some legal, psychological advice before you do anything.
So
like,
is it that sometimes that is a good idea and sometimes it's not? You just want to get advice.
That's right. Okay. Or sometimes you want to wait until, I mean, this is where it gets tricky, because if you go to court, if the judge does understand and validates that this, in fact, falls under the statute, not all states have the statute, but there are loopholes to how you can use it if you don't. California does. Then it can offer what we call, you know, a TRO, which is a temporary restraining order, or a protective order, which will put a lot more hindrance on and boundaries on the perpetrator. And especially if this is a custodial thing and there are kids involved, where it could help is that the perpetrator is doing anything to get their kids back. So it will be like, it gives the, there's somewhat of a carrot for them to not act on it.
Understood.
Right. So it's really, it's going to be case by case.
Got it.
So let's just quickly revisit the ways in which stalkers use coercive control. They isolate their victims. They will monitor your activities throughout the day. They do this by wiring your house with cameras or sensors, recording devices. Sometimes they'll use two-way surveillance to speak to you at home during the day. So this invasive surveillance often extends to private areas such as the bedroom, even the bathroom, adding an element of humiliation. So we know that humiliation is part of coercive control. Anything that robs the person of their personal freedom and liberty, it adds humiliation to what is already a clear boundary violation. So Dr. Wendy L. Patrick says, who's a career trial attorney. So denying freedom by following their target, restricting the target's access to support in their environment, hacking into their phone, changing passwords, accessing important documents. They may limit their target's access to money by draining their accounts, rigorously monitoring what the target spends. So the person may go to the store and need to buy something, and all of a sudden the credit card cuts off, or it's maxed, or money's pulled out of the account, things like that. It's important for anyone, but statistics show mostly for cisgender women and trans folks to understand the benchmarks of domestic violence and how to identify when they might be in a situation where someone in their life begins to utilize coercive control or constant surveillance and attempt to control their lives. So we want to talk about lowering risk factors. And when we are trying to make somebody safer, we are adding protective factors, because adding protective factors is something we're actually in control of. We may not always be in control of lowering risk, because we can't change the dangerousness of right. this other person. What we can do is put things in our lives that ultimately lower the risk because we're heightening the protection. So for example, keeping a support system in place and having an emergency out. Mm. Maybe there's one or two people in your life that you trust with this, and you can say, hey, I'm just going to, I have someone in my life right now who I've said, all I want you to do if you're in trouble is send an emoji, this emoji. You're not going to have time to type it out or grab your phone or say a whole thing. If I get this emoji from you, I know you're in trouble, yeah. right? Because it might have to be something very, very fast. Recording and tracking any information that could be evidence of stalking will be important, because telling law enforcement will not be enough. Hearsay. He said, she said, she said, she said, whatever. We want things that are tracked evidence that can actually be used in court, right? So if you're just like, but he said this to me, everyone's gonna be like, well, that's hearsay. We can't prove it. So anything that you can document or have recorded. If you can afford legal counsel, you might want to think about making a case if the stalking is persistent, threatening to emotional and physical well-being. So legal counsel is expensive. And what makes these cases very, very, very expensive is because, like Stark said, it's such an unidentified form of abuse that these cases can go on and on, because the perpetrator is now engaging in what we call legal abuse, which is turning the tables and flipping the script to making the victim or the target actually look like they're the problem. Mm-hmm. So now it elongates. It's much easier. I was talking to a medical doctor the other day who I'm going to be presenting with at this conference. And we were talking about how it takes 2 seconds to tell a lie, but it takes so much longer to carry that burden of proof and disprove that lie.
Yeah.
So anybody can go in and say, you're alienating me from my children. And now the burden of proof falls on the person who's like, I'm not. And now I have to present something I didn't do.
This is literally all of media right now.
Yes, that's right.
You know, any celebrity media, to make it more relatable to everyone. It's like when you watch celebrity media and you see them spread some rumor.
Absolutely.
And then now that person's got to prove that it's not true.
That's exactly right.
Because we all believe it. Mm-hmm. As soon as we hear it, you can say anything.
100%. That's a great analogy. Some emotional signs that you might be in a situation, in a relationship, doesn't always have to be an intimate. It could be a parent, it could be a coworker, a boss. It could be someone who is in a position of being able to subjugate you in some way, shape, or form. So you might be feeling denial, confusion, self-doubt, questioning of what is happening. You know, is this unreasonable? Wondering if they themselves are overreacting. So there's like, we start to gaslight ourselves. Mm-hmm. Frustration, guilt, embarrassment, blaming ourselves, apprehension, fear, terror of being alone, or that they or others or their pets will be harmed. So, you know, if we think about hypervigilance of the nervous system, if you're always in that state of apprehension or fear or feeling like something bad is going to happen, you should be questioning your relationships and what's going on in your life.
Absolutely.
If you're feeling isolated and helpless around the harassment stopping, you don't know who to talk to. You don't feel anyone's going to believe you. You start to feel depressed and all symptoms related to depression. You might start to have anxiety, panic attacks, agoraphobia, which is, you know, feeling frightened to leave the house or never feeling a sense of safety. We know that the mental and the physical work together. So alongside these mental health symptoms, we might also experience some physical symptoms. So fatigue from difficulty sleeping, right? You're not sleeping well if you're always on hyper alert or having nightmares. Being constantly on guard. Effects of chronic stress could include headaches, hypertension, gastrointestinal problems. There could be fluctuations in weight due to not eating or comfort eating, development or exacerbation of pre-existing conditions, asthma, gastric ulcers, psoriasis, dizziness, okay? We know that autoimmune stuff is oftentimes, it's correlated with folks who have relational trauma and this sort of chronic, you know, emotionally violent, if you're in something like this for a long period of time, people can start to develop really horrific health problems, including autoimmune or inflammation. So where the body starts to attack itself, essentially. So getting into therapy, if you can do that, especially though, with a clinician who has a background in understanding this. So then people always ask me, what do I look for? How do I know? You can vet your clinicians. If they're telling you to go to a CODA meeting, if they're telling you, you know, let's not talk about someone who's not in the room, these are probably not the right clinicians for you.
That's problematic.
You know, because we do want to get to a point where we want to make it about empowerment and talking about, well, where could you have maybe gone astray or what did you learn early on that led you to, but if you do that too quickly, it can feel very victim blaming. It can feel very gaslighting. Mm-hmm. That's the work later. The early work is really recognizing, like validating that this person is in something dangerous.
Yeah. Most of the time when I work with people who have suffered under coercive control or who are in intimate relationships with narcissists.
Yeah.
Which presents similarly is that it's often a chunk of time just identifying that they're with a narcissist.
Yeah.
Or that it's even happening. Like that takes a really long time. Right. Just all the validation that they gather from me saying, is this person doing XYZ?
Right.
And them saying, yeah, how did you know that? I said, well, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how I might have guessed that or, you know.
That's right.
And then like, just like bringing all of that to consciousness is often like a lot of the beginning work.
That's right.
They just know they're unhappy and anxious and they can't please their partner.
That's right.
Is often what it is. And it's like, well.
Or if they do come in knowing, because they've done the research, a lot of times I'll get them coming in because they know that I work with folks who've been through this.
That makes sense, because you're advertising that as like something that you specialize in.
Yeah.
So they would come to it knowing.
And if they come to it knowing, I allow them to talk about that other person for a while.
Of course.
So that's important, because it's what we call post-traumatic rumination, right? Like there's a level of that that needs to happen before you can then say, I wonder what it would feel like if we just talked about you, because you do want to get there.
Yep.
But it takes some time and it takes some validation.
Patience is what our work is, honestly.
Absolutely. It is. It's a lot. If you're a clinician doing this work, you're going to have the answers before they do. And what you don't want to do is go, I know what's going on. You really want to help them. You want to manage your anxiety around just handing them all this. And honestly, if they can't get out of their situation, you don't want to overwhelm them.
Well, and that's the other thing that they rush to. But I know we're going down a rabbit hole, but I'll just say, like, clinicians can rush to the solution.
Yeah, we got to be careful with that.
With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, motion sounds something like this. Kizik helps you experience the magic of motion. With over 200 patents and easy on, easy off technology, you'll never have to touch your shoes again. There are hundreds of styles and colors, plus a squish like nothing you've ever felt. For a limited time, get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Another thing, so this next piece is from a website called stalkingriskprofile.com. And there's a section on why victims may not reach out for help. And this is also really important, especially if you're a judge or you're an attorney, to understand that not understanding that what is happening to them is stalking or illegal. Because if we're in an intimate relationship, if we're legally married to somebody or in some sort of domestic partnership, some people don't believe that consent exists anymore. Or that, you know, all of a sudden it's like, well, it took two of you to get here. There's this idea that there's this term that's oftentimes used in family court that I absolutely hate. And it's called high conflict. This is a high conflict divorce. It's like, no, sometimes it is, but that's like saying mutual combat, right?
Yeah.
Every now and then mutual combat does happen, but it's usually an outlier. There's usually one incredibly problematic person who is making this case go on and on and on, because most people really just don't want to stay in it.
No.
They want it to be done. They want to share custody. They want to get down to the nitty gritty. They want it to be done. Mm-hmm. In situations like this, you know, a lot of times people don't even realize, and like what Shannon was just talking about, is even getting to that point in therapy where it's like, oh my God, this is abuse. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know. So there lies the patients who we're talking about.
Yeah.
They might try to pretend that it's not happening. And if you double down as a clinician and move too fast, you've just shut down any opportunity for them to even be able to digest that.
Yeah, because for me, because I'm not really advertising that that's something that I work with a lot, even though I do, for whatever reason, you know, we get the clients that we specialize in, no matter whether you advertise it or not. That's one of those things in this industry, is that, yeah, a lot of times I'm dealing much more with the pre-contemplative stage where they don't know that they're not the problem.
That's right.
They're coming to help, to get help, because they've identified and their person has identified that they're the problem. And then we're piecing that apart over the course of a long time, usually.
Yeah. And that's really important to think about, because if you force somebody too quickly through that, you may actually be creating a much longer therapeutic process.
That's for sure.
One thing I want to, without going back too far, when we're talking about some of the emotional signs, what I find is an overextension of empathy can also be a sign of trauma, where someone doesn't have boundaries around empathy, where they're essentially, you know, I'm not suggesting to not find the good in everybody, but there is a level of overextension of empathy that's been programmed from previous either childhood abuse, things like that, where the child was expected to carry the moral responsibility. Mm-hmm. And therefore in every relationship they're in, this person could be just tearing them down. And they're like, well, it's not their fault. They were abused as a kid. That is something that's a learned behavior. So, you know, just check in with yourself. overly empathizing, right? Are you doing that without condition? So something to think about. Okay. Believing that they should be able to deal with the situation, thinking that the stalker will see reason or not wanting to get the stalker into trouble. I think if I just talk to him, maybe it's not as, but he's just having a, you know, whatever. This person didn't become this way overnight. They can't be talked out of it. And you certainly cannot talk them out of it. Fear that others will think they are overreacting or that they'll be blamed for somehow having encouraged the stalker in the first place. The latter is particularly pertinent for those who have had previous intimate relationships with the stalker, even if it was only brief or just a flirtation. Fears about how the stalker will respond either to them or those that they love or care for. Direct threats. You know, it's pretty scary when someone directly threatens you and then you're like, I'm going to cut you off cold turkey. You're worried what they're going to do. We know that when someone leaves a relationship, the chance of them being harmed if this person is violent, you know, triples. It goes up quite a bit. So that's why we have to create safety plans and things like that for folks. Feeling isolated in their plight, believing that there's nothing that can be done to help them or not knowing who to go to because they're left with a legal system that is oftentimes just as narcissistic or it's a huge obstacle and victims aren't believed. So they end up feeling more isolated and they develop what we call like a sense of learned helplessness. Previous requests for help are ignored. That could even be by friends or family because they don't believe that this person's really that bad. Fear of losing their job or the situation becoming more difficult when stalking originates in the workplace. Financial limitations in regard to or with regard to seeking legal advice or taking time off to seek help. Limited options in respect to changing their situation, relocation to safer housing. And this last one, I have a couple cases. Language barriers, people who are in English as a second language because they're very vulnerable in their situation. So I talked about how, you know, how can one increase their personal protection? How do we raise those protective factors? Lower the risk. So should the individual attempt to talk with their perpetrator, especially if they have a previous relationship with them? No, absolutely not. Don't engage. Don't become a live wire. Okay? Because when I've worked with folks, they're like, well, I just, you know, maybe I'll just respond through text so that way he won't just show up at my house. He's going to show up at your house anyway. Okay.
It's what they want.
And the second you engage, you now become that live wire. So no contact is always key. Where it gets tricky is if you are sharing children and the court is forcing you to have contact. That's a whole other episode. Okay. Any other form of contact could be perceived as engaging with this person. If the stalker corners you or there's an accidental contact, you know, you see them at the store, they follow you there. Do not show any emotion. Remove yourself as quickly as possible. Walk to a public place. There's no reason to engage. You are not going to be able to do anything except now you've turned the switch on. Tell other people. Is there anyone you can tell? So they know. People should know that this person is stalking you. So they do not speak to them about you or give information without knowing it could be dangerous. Give a description of this person, the car they drive. If nobody in your life knows that this person is a stalker, and they're, I don't know, you were married to them for 5 years and they run into your best friend on the street and,
just give them all the information.
Like, hey, how's Cindy doing? Oh, you know, she's still going to that bar on Friday nights.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. You should stop by.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Every Friday night at 8.
She does
bingo and trivia.
Yeah, don't keep it a secret.
Don't. Alert your support to notice anything out of the ordinary, including contact from the stalker themselves. They may call up your best friend and be like, how's Cindy doing? I don't know who Cindy is. I'm making Cindy up, but.
Cindy is your friend.
Cindy Lou Who. It makes your case stronger by documenting your conversations with other people. Paper trails are super important. Text messages count. If you have children, create boundaries and information. Create boundaries and inform the children to not pick up the phone or answer the door. You know, obviously this is more difficult if the other parent is the stalker. So again, different episode. Protect your pets. Keep them inside. I know that sounds absurd, but these people will do things to slash your Achilles heel. And if they know your pets and your kids and your property are where everything, like that's the center of your world, they will fuck with it without any care. They will do anything to torment you, including harming your pets and your children. Change your daily routines. Do not allow this person to catch wind of how you come and go. If they already know this, switch it up, right? If you get up every morning and go for a 7 a.m. walk, they're going to follow you. They're going to know when you get back. They're going to know all this. If you can afford to, look into hiring a private investigator. I've had clients who have done this quite a bit to follow this person. This can be helpful in court. You can have pictures and you can have documents showing what this person is doing. Change locks or codes to locks. I have found that having locks without keys that have codes are really helpful. You can change those codes every now and then. We have on our front door our code, and then we have several codes that we can give. Let's say we have a maintenance guy that needs to come in. The second he leaves, we can change it.
That's right.
Right? Or we have like the people that maybe come over that pet sit.
Yep.
They have their own code. If you can change that and put, you know, Ring cameras or Nest cams to have more, you know, that Google Home does a really good, they have a really good product, right? Fairly inexpensive.
That's why a lot of hotels are now fully code,
absolutely
code oriented.
Yep. Sensor lights, another really good one to have. You can tell if someone's approaching. They can't fake out those sensor lights. Here's another one that's challenging for folks, but I do recommend, is consider getting rid of social media for a while. Mm-hmm. Kind of stay off of that. They can track that and you will get caught up in following them.
Yeah.
Okay. These can be avenues used to track a target, and also they can start to mess with you knowing that you're following them. Even if you're not following them, if they have they'll oftentimes have a public profile because mm-hmm. they know you can go on it. Mm-hmm. They will post things to provoke. Always have the most up-to-date virus and firewall protection from a reputable source so they can't break in.
Yeah.
To iClouds, things like that. I've been on cases where they've had to hire forensic tech folks to talk about how this person could have gotten in and how much information were they able to get.
Yes.
Right? The very last thing that I will talk about is common mistakes that victims make.
That'll be really helpful.
Yeah, I think that we're all doing the best we can.
Yeah, we can all, it doesn't matter how smart you are, how savvy you are, if you're a forensic psychologist even,
yeah,
we can all get caught up in a lot of this stuff.
That's right, and we can all be victims to it.
Absolutely.
Right? Keep in mind that a lot of targets are too trusting of others. So in these situations, you want to limit any information to strangers, the internet, through email. These people will use phishing tactics. They will send people to your home. I'm on a case right now where, and this is, again, the court just is like, doesn't even hit them, where the woman, the ex, is still owns the house, but monitors her. And we'll send quote unquote like workers to the house to like fix the plumbing. And then the son is like, these aren't plumbers, right? They're coming in,
yeah.
They're getting it right. How do you prove that to the court, right? This is where it gets really hard. They just float right underneath that radar.
Yep.
So don't give information to people you don't know. Intuition is something to listen to. Okay. If you've never read the book, The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker, one of the best threat assessment officers, if not the best in the world, he will tell women, listen, if some guy calls you a bitch because you said, no, I don't need help carrying my groceries to my car, he goes, be a bitch, be the biggest bitch, because you're listening to your gut. And your gut is, it's not that your gut is always right, but your gut is telling you to ask more questions.
Yeah, don't be the nice girl.
Do not ignore it. You might, because you've been gaslighted into doing that from your abuser or from childhood. The gut tells us to take the situation seriously and to ask more questions. Here's another thing, and this is by no means is an insult to law enforcement, but do not expect law enforcement to take care of this. Okay. You have to be proactive and prepared. You have to build your own paper trail of things, because we know, if you go back to listen to episode one, the stalking laws and what it takes by the time they actually get themselves involved, sometimes these people are dead.
Yes.
So think through potential consequences of getting a protective order or domestic violence restraining order. These can help or hurt depending on the situation. Trying to fix things by using a weapon. I've had people say, should I get a gun? If you aren't, this is not a message around gun banning or whether guns are okay or not. Here is what this message is. If you are not trained appropriately, this could result in the weapon being used against you. I've had clients ask me if they should get a gun. This is not a political statement. It's a statement of safety. It's about whether you feel safe being able to use that against someone, especially someone you have maybe have been in a marriage or partnership with. Or are you going to get vulnerable in that moment and they're going to turn it around and use it against you? There could also be children and pets in the house who could be harmed from a misfire. People also fail to give a direct message to the stalker that they want them to stop and are no longer interested in this engagement. Okay? Directness and then no contact. I was just mentioning Gavin DeBecker a moment ago, the nation's leading expert on violent behavior, and in his book, The Gift of Fear, offers specific ways to protect yourself and those you love, including how to act when approached by a stranger, when you should fear someone close to you, what to do if you're being stalked, how to uncover the source of anonymous threats or phone calls, the biggest mistakes we can make with a threatening person, and more, all in this book. He shatters the myth that most acts of violence are unpredictable. It's all about learning to tap into the sixth sense around danger and not self-doubting, he says. Real versus perceived fear. There are times where our fear is very warranted. And if you are feeling something that's off, listen to that. So I really recommend his book.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that. Oh, it's a lot. I hope that you guys, anybody who's listening that actually really needed this advice in how to, generally speaking, obviously seek counsel from the people that you are seeking counsel from, lawyers, etc., in your very specific case. But for any of you who might be just contemplating the fact that you might need to start moving into action on your own, which can be a very empowering thing as well, and a very scary thing as well, to start to do what you can to help the people that are trying to help you, just to survive it, obviously, without getting harmed. And I hope this has given you some information, some ideas, some hope, some motivation to seek support, but also some of the things that you can begin to do if you suspect something like this.
Thanks for that.
This has been an episode of Terror Talk. My name is Shannon.
And I'm Kathy. Sleep safe, everyone.